Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
This interview from the Toronto International Film Festival 2016 is with Maya Zinchdine. This was the international premiere of her film, Forever Pure. Maya's a journalist, and she is someone who's full of life. We have a lot of fun in this conversation. You're going to enjoy this interview about her film, Forever Pure. The film itself is about football on the surface, and we get a good history of what's going on in Israel and what's happening with the game and what's happening with nationalism and racism and anger and hate, and all these things kind of bubbled to the surface. This is a documentary with a lot going on in it, and yeah, you're going to enjoy the film. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. And it's really quite disturbing because, as you'll find out pretty quickly, this film is really not about football, or maybe as in our Canadian and American case, about soccer. And I think really, as Maya says, the main issue for her is about silence and about what we don't say and what we don't do and how we don't act and so on. So check it out. The film is called Forever Pure. It's at the film festival. I'm hoping you'll be able to get to it online or at a festival down the road if you don't get a chance during the festival. Maya Zinchdine coming up, Forever Pure, davidpecklive.com and rabble.ca for more podcasts and more interviews. And if you'd like to book me at your next event to speak or to podcast there live on stage, please check me out online, davidpecklive.com. And my new book, Real Change is Incremental, is available there too. Maya Zinchdine and Forever Pure. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today here live at the Toronto International Film Festival after the international premiere of her new film. We're with Maya Zinchdine today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's too damn early, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
especially after the opening night.
Exactly.
How late?
It's good that you're not seeing me now.
how late did the party go, is the question.
Well, actually, we ended up on drinking whiskey in the sidewalk next to the hotel.
No wonder you're late. Which was perfect.
We did the same thing after the Jerusalem premiere.
Okay. So there's a bit of a pattern developing here then.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
I think it's
so
good.
Premiere, Q&A, lots of whiskey.
Yeah. No, it starts with premiere, Q&A, dinner with gin and tonic, and then it ends up with whiskey. So you can imagine how it's difficult for me now.
Oh, man, I do have some painkillers here, and I'm sure we could maybe we can have another shot of whiskey before the interview's over.
Yeah, it might help.
Oh, man, that's hilarious. Well, good for you, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
On a wonderful film.
Thanks.
And an engaging film, really compelling on so many levels, and I don't even like soccer.
Okay.
That's actually not true. I used to play, and my son plays. But I there's something I've never really quite understood is that that nationalism that goes alongside of my father, that goes alongside of the game or any game for that matter. But my dad was from the UK,
okay.
So I do understand some of that craziness around football. But we Canadians, we're pretty quiet on when it comes to certain things, you know, as I'm sure you're finding out. Anyway, let's talk about your film. Tell me, I've just read a review or an article recently. The two main sort of protagonists, I guess you could say, the two Muslim football players. You were the first person to meet them.
Yeah.
When they got tell us about that, but tell us about the film as well.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm also a journalist. And I was asked by an Israeli TV show to make a story about the two Muslim players. Actually, they called me and asked me, what are you doing within 2 hours? I said, I don't know.
And had you been drinking whiskey the night before?
No. Oh, no, okay. Come on. I'm not drinking. I'm just drinking whiskey once after the premiere. It happens once in 3 years.
There's no pattern here.
No right? pattern
okay.
here.
Okay, I don't have to. Be
even though I'm Russian.
That's right.
I'm born in Russia, but...
should have been vodka, not whiskey. Right?
So I'm very progressive Russian.
You are a progressive Russian, indeed. So, journalist... 2 hours.
Yeah.
Can you go do a story, not a film?
A story, just a story.
Yeah.
And they said, so did you hear about the Chechens, Beitar? And I said, yeah, something. So they said, so great. So just can you do it? We have an exclusive interview with them. And in 2 hours, I found myself with the two Chechen players in one car. None of us know what's going on. Around us, so and then I spent the first 3 days with them and with the club, and I was shocked from the hate.
So you hadn't really been aware of it up until this point, because this is an old football club.
Of course. Well, when you live in Israel, and I would say even if you're Jewish, you has to be aware of Beitar. It's the most controversial. It's a huge club, and it's also because it's this club is started as a political movement, so it's much more than football. When you're a Beitar fan, it says a lot of things about your identity, about your political views. It's mostly not football. It's a kind of something that representing you.
Well, this is one of the things I love about your film. It's really not about football. It's really not about soccer at all.
Yeah.
And yet the majority of the film either revolves on the playing field or with the fans or in the locker room. So it's a really interesting sort of almost essay into issues of racism and identity and hate. And so you weren't there with a camera, or were you that first day? Was it a camera?
Yeah. It was with the camera, but it was for this TV show. But so after 3 days, this story has been shown. But I understood that actually the real story has just begun, because I just saw this. I was shocked from this hate, and I told myself, come on, it's ridiculous. It's just the football players. So I came to the chairman and told him, listen, I think you're doing here something really, really big, and I think a film should be done about this process. He said, well, that's a great idea. Do you have anyone in mind? I said, yes, myself. and then he just told me, okay, give me a day to think about it. Oh, and he asked me what's the, how it's going to be. I said, well, everything has to be open. He said, okay, and when I will watch the film? I said to him, well, in the premiere.
Interesting. Okay, so that's clearly the journalist coming.
Yeah,
you. I want lots of freedom.
Yeah,
and I don't want you restricting me.
Exactly.
In any way.
Exactly. But that's part of me. I cannot work differently. Otherwise, I would think it won't be honest. That was really important for me. And he did actually watch it in the premiere.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. So how did you get a film like that funded?
So, actually,
first time filmmaker?
No, it's my first time as a director,
but
I produced documentaries
before.
Yeah. So I knew...
You've been in the world.
I've been in the world, and actually that's also helped me to bring on board many friends, because there was no financing through all the filming of the season. So it was just lots of favors of my friends.
Wow.
And at some point, it was not enough, the favors, because people were working.
Yes.
So I just, I invested my own money at some point, because I knew that I have to keep going.
Well, I guess at some point you get involved into a story like this, not only as a journalist, but as a filmmaker, and say, I need to tell more of this story. I need to get to, there's no way I can't not tell it. I have to get to the bottom of this.
Yes, of
right?
course. Because I think when it was keep rolling and it became crazier and crazier and crazier, you just can't stop. You just saying, come on, what's going on here?
Because, like, is this real or
is this fact or fiction? Yeah,
this
because this can't be happening. Exactly. I think if someone would write a script about it,
right,
someone would say to him, nah, it's not real. You know, it's too much, because like all the steps of the film, when this crazy hatred, and then. The small group of the fans of the radical that actually getting so much power and making 20,000 people not to come to the stadium, which is amazing.
It's pretty incredible.
And it just every time it became more and more.
So just for the listeners, so there's a few thousand fans, regular basis, very. Maya's talked about the hatred, and you really don't get a sense for it until you see the film.
Yeah.
And you see the things that they're saying and so on. But yeah, 20,000 people boycott basically the game, which is remarkable.
Yeah. It's
especially based on what they're talking about and thinking about. You've been getting, I understand, death threats as well because of the film, and I would imagine a lot of pushback.
Well, actually, the threats came much later, not during the filming. I published 10 minutes on The Guardian a half year ago in The Guardian doc, and it went totally crazy.
Well, out of control is a phrase that's used in the film a couple times from a few people.
Yeah.
That's an understatement.
It's out of control. it went out of control.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
In many steps of this film, it felt like it's totally going out of control.
Were you ever, during the filming of it, and then I'd love to talk about some of the issues, clearly, that your film brings up, were you ever at a time with the camera, with your crew, small crew, concerned in the middle of it?
Not really, but maybe because I'm kind of used to find myself in this situation. So
my previous
documentary as a producer was about Russian mafia.
So you like light subjects, basically.
My friends laughing about me that I'm really trying to kill myself in many different ways.
That's right.
So I'm not. I do believe that you can, as a filmmaker, you can do lots of things if you're doing smart. So, I do believe. Well, I know it. I'm really afraid of heights, for example, but I'm usually not afraid of people.
Interesting.
Do believe that you can manage kind of conversation.
Well, there was a part of me. It's a really interesting comment that you make. Usually not afraid of people, because there's a part of me that I finished watching your film Forever Pure, which is a wonderful title, by the way, which is also kind of a phrase.
Yeah.
We have yellow flowing through our blood and veins.
Yeah.
Remarkable. I mean, it's just, you don't have to go too far to see the craziness of that, the wildness of that statement. I kind of feel like I'm a little afraid of other people after watching your film. I mean, you know what I mean? Like you say, this can't be true.
Yeah, but the thing is that I'm not afraid of people when it's one-on-one.
Mm.
I do afraid of masses. I do afraid of the power of the masses. I do afraid of ideas that can drive the masses towards very dangerous places. But I do believe, for me as a filmmaker, that on one-on-one, you can always speak. I don't know when I'm, and again, maybe when I'm filming, I have this kind of very weird feeling that the camera is protecting me, even though, of course, it's not.
Do you think these are just crazy fans? Or is this hatred, is this anger, this racism really flowing through their blood and veins?
I'm sorry, but I think it's not that and not that.
Because,
first of all, I do think that there's a deep ideology in it. And they're just not crazy fans. And because they're human beings, thinking human beings that deciding. From other hand, I don't think it's because in a way they're all in every society. You have this small part, extreme part, that takes it to a different level. The problem is when this part with these ideas succeeding on to affect the masses. So, in a way, the masses doesn't have to shout death to Arabs. They just can not to come to the stadium. And by that, it in a very internal kind of feeling to agree with the idea of the extreme. But the extreme, they would be always extreme. The question is how it's affecting on the
Collectively.
Yeah, collectively.
Which you bring up really well, raised those questions, the boycotting of the stadium, some of the political, some of the politicians who, well, there's a great line in the film about the silence. If we're, that's actually been a bit of a theme for me at the film festival this year, mm-hmm. Some of the documentary filmmakers, this idea that silence is you're being complicit. You're almost saying kind of saying it's okay.
Yeah, of course, of course. And for me, that's the main issue of this film, because I really don't think that the fans, and I know it would sound really weird, I don't think that the fans are the bad guy in the film. I do think that it's the powers are the bad guy, in a way, because they're legitimizing by their silence these extreme small groups that then getting more and more power. Because if you're a responsible leader...
Well, the scene with the former prime minister standing on the balcony in front of all the fans cheering, and he comes, and basically the thinking is, well, I can reach 20,000 people in one moment.
Yeah.
And he says, I have two words for you. Go guitar.
Yeah.
And the question that I want to ask is, what are you saying with those two words, right? You've all of a sudden just got your support
everything.
with a football club that goes so deep, that seems to have such racist undertones, such a deep sense of nationalism. I mean, it really is frightening, you know, some of the images that you bring out in the film, and it's quite remarkable. So Arkady, is that how
Arkady.
You... Arkady. Quote, not a very fascinating sport, but it's kind of a war.
Yeah.
And then he says, I mean, he's quite a character.
He's
really,
amazing.
Really is.
He is.
And then he says, it's an interesting propaganda tool.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's all kinds of academics and intellectuals and sociologists who would agree.
Of course. But the thing is
it's not about football at all.
But as you saw, our politicians knows that this propaganda tool, because when our prime minister, he's a former, but he's also now Netanyahu, is the current prime minister, says, go Beitar, he's using Beitar as a propaganda tool.
Yes, yes.
He's just not saying that.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
But this is what he's doing.
Two words.
But it's a brilliant word.
It's
words
brilliant.
Because he's making themselves, he makes himself to be on the same level with the fans. He's like part of them. And it's a brilliant, you know, and it's like something that you're saying about this club, go Beitar, so people can feel that, oh, he's just like me, he's the fan of this club. So Arkady, in a way, doing exactly the same thing that all the other politicians doing, that he's just admitting.
One of the more moderate guys that you interview in the film is a fan, I think.
Yeah.
And I can't, I'm Errol, maybe, Errol? And he said, you know, the Beitar became a political symbol for the underprivileged. So when the prime minister says, or any politician says, go Beitar, the message runs pretty deep, it seems to me.
Of
right?
course.
This is, he's on our side. He's for us.
Yeah.
He's got our concerns.
Yes, of course.
Are on his table.
Because, that's, I don't know if we want to go there, but because it goes a little bit to the history of Israel, but the right wing came to power in Israel only in 77. Till then, it was the left wing, and the unprivileged were the people that actually felt that they're the underdog,
right.
And then the right wing came to power. But the amazing thing that 30 years the right wing is in power in Israel, and they still think about themselves as the underdog.
Right.
I had
Right.
Oh, it's a quote that didn't came into the film, but I'm interviewing there Victor Lieberman. He's the then he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and today he's the Minister of Defense. And he's saying, and I'm asking him, what is the meaning to being a Beitar fan? He says, well, it's to be the underdog, it's to be out of the regime, and then saying to you, till you became the regime, you are the regime now.
Right.
And he says, no, no, we're not. I'm saying, you're the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
right.
But this feeling of, and that's amazing how you still, how they, even after 30 years in power, the right wing and Beitar always feel as the underdog.
Right.
And the politicians are using these feelings of being the unprivileged.
You know what's so beautiful? There's so many metaphors and symbols in your film. One of the ones I love in particular, which, and I guess my point is that, you know, metaphor and symbol, especially when it comes to race and nationalism and religion and politics, are so important, right?
Yes.
But the colors of the stadium,
yeah,
fascinating. Yes. So when the stadium is empty, you've got, it's multicolored. I noticed it sort of later in the film, and it's an utterly brilliant symbol for everything that we should be working towards. Does it make sense? Do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure.
So the stadium's empty.
Yeah.
And you've got all these beautiful colors of the seats, and I guess
they're just
seats that are different sections. So you pay more for the red
than you do for
the green. But when all the people are there, there's this sameness.
Yes.
Right? Everybody seems to be the same, and there's these anchors. Oh, and then you've got this great shot in the film where people are going crazy, the whole out of control thing, and there's an advertisement, and it says drink responsibly. And I laughed out loud. Something that you guys weren't doing last night, by the way. You know, the whiskey on the sidewalk, yes. Not paying attention to your own advice. But I just laughed out loud, the irony of that. And again, it's a symbol, it's a metaphor. It's a part of the world we live in with iPhones and images, and there's always messages being communicated.
Yes, of course.
Right?
Of course.
So I love the way the Russian billionaire basically says, I did this. Mm-hmm. I brought these two guys in just to show what this whole country, what this whole system was really about. Do you think that was true?
I think it was partially. Yes, I do think it's true. And I think it was combined. There was a thing about the business issue between him and the Chechen president. But Arkady is very angry on the Israeli society because he put billions of dollars of trying to become the mayor of Jerusalem. Actually, lots of money for amazing social causes really helped to so many people. But I don't know who said to him around him that he actually can become the mayor of Jerusalem, because it was quite clear that he has zero chances.
Right.
Really. But and I think for him, getting 3.6% of the votes, it was so insulting that it was a kind of a revenge for him, kind of to expose.
Oh, I see. Right.
To expose this society.
Would you agree it's the kind of thing that history will look back on and say, wow, that was a real, there was a splash and a ripple effect from that.
Yes.
His reaction, his anger, his ego got in the way, and yet look at what changed as a result of it, or look at the conversation that occurred. I mean, you wouldn't be making this film if he hadn't made the decision.
Yeah,
right? It's
of
kind
course.
Of interesting.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. Well, actually, all this idea of, for me, it was so interesting of, and that's why it was important for me to bring all the pyramid into the film, in a way, from the leaders, the owner, and to the very, to the, you know, I hate this word, but small people, like the regular people, and how the decisions of these leaders is actually affecting on the at the end there was two people that suffered and another goalkeeper that suffered and to bring in one film the person that caused it and the people that suffering and kind of to try to draw all the picture and of course this season is deeply affected on the life of example of the goalkeeper that I met him a few months ago, and it happened 3 years ago, and he's still in the story. He never moved forward.
So you mean the conversation hasn't moved forward about the issues itself, or do you mean?
No, the conversation about the actually, well, I think it's developed in many levels. For example, La Familia. I had been speaking with some sport journalists about it, and I told them, listen, before this season, you could never hear about La Familia out of the sport sections in the news. They moved. They became a political power in a sense. Now you will hear about them in the main news stories. They are not only an ultras anymore. And actually, it's very interesting because when I did the research after I finished filming, I really tried to understand what actually I captured because. You know, kind of make zoom out and look on all this footage and say, okay, but what's the story that I'm telling? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I spoke with a sociologist, and he said the football stadium is not only a mirror for the society, that's of course, right. Everybody knows, but it's actually, he takes it one step forward and he says, it's not only reflecting, but that's actually the place where you can see the first place where you can see what's the direction of the society. If you want to know what's going to happen in the future, just go to the stadium.
And so people show their true colors.
Yeah, because it's a game and it's very emotional thing. So
sure, sure.
If you want to know where we're going, just go to the stadium. And then I understood that that's how that's what I actually and filmed. And you know, the amazing thing that's literally what happened. This La Familia that grew up with their power, today they are an existing strong power in the streets, in the political discourse. So, and that's amazing for me because in a way, I always say, I saw how it born, you know? Because for them it was their first huge victory.
Right,
and afterwards, they understood because I spoke with them
won,
later.
They won in a sense.
Yeah,
yeah.
They totally won.
Yeah.
And as a small group that understood what kind of power they had, I don't think I know that they didn't assume that it would be such a huge success.
Yeah. As a journalist, what are you more interested in, would you say? We're going to have to wrap it up in a couple minutes, but are you more interested in just telling the story and letting people do with it what they will? Or would you say there's a, I hate the word, I don't like the word agenda, but I mean, you've created a conversation out of this film, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And I would like to think, and I think in your postscript, you certainly, it sounds like there's a little bit of hope there. And some of the people you interview certainly seem to suggest that there's hope in the country for moving forward, for all of us, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a story for us all. This isn't just about the Beitar and Israel and so on. This is for all of us. There's elements of every one of us.
I agree.
How do we listen to others? I love the scene I can't remember his name. I'm sorry. Jaru, one of the players, praying, one of the
Jibril.
Jibril, thank you. In the bus.
Yeah, Jibril.
And that split, that divide, that you know, religion, this side, that it's so polarizing, all of this stuff. Why, you know, can't we just sit down and have a cup of tea?
Well,
I know that's a bit of an oversimplification.
No, but I must say that when I was filming, I always was thinking, come on, football, soccer, it's biggest religion in the world, right? It's above religion. Right?
I think you might be right.
It doesn't, on the pitch, we're all the same. So football has to win in this film. And football didn't win in this film.
Right, it's true.
There is something bigger than football.
Something bigger and something deeply unsettling. So you still didn't answer the question?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Are you hopeful?
I'm always hopeful.
Oh, good.
Yeah, because...
is that the whiskey talking, by the way?
No. Oh, good. No. When I'm without hangover, I'm always... I do think that there's hope. I think it's... I think society knows how to change. I hope so. I really don't. And you know, my dream is to show this, that every child, school kid in Israel will watch this film.
Wow.
That's my dream, because that's our future. And actually, well, I would say, of course, it's too big to say that every child, school child in the world will watch this film, but as much as possible, because for me, that's an amazing way to tell a story of how racism destroys you from within.
Well, this is what's so brilliant, I think, about your film, Maya, is that you couldn't have picked a more common denominator, a more common sort of almost tool, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's talking about the scores from the game last night on some level.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And they recognize their team and so on. So there's this commonality there that hopefully, as you say, as kids see it, as parents see it, as people see it, that there will be a conversation that comes out of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a remarkable
I has been asked about what I would like that people will think when they coming out of the film, and I said I would love them to think, oh my God, I have to bring my kid to watch it.
Right. Yes. Yes, and the next time they kick a football, may they never think the same way again about the sport.
Yeah,
and but some of the underlying implications.
Yeah, but it it's a very not a didactic way to talk about this issue that is of racism, that is everywhere, and it hurts us all the time.
Yeah.
And for me, I think that this film can become a great tool for us to tell to the next generation, just to show it. And actually, about your previous question, do I have agenda? Do I prefer just to show it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I prefer to show it, because
nice.
And actually, that's the reaction that I got from the chairman and from the coach after the premiere. They just saying, that's amazing. You just showed exactly what happened.
Mm.
You're not pushing your agenda.
Right.
You're just showing. And when people that were inside of it telling me just in 100% showed exactly what happened, me as a filmmaker, that's the greatest thing.
That's wonderful.
Because I think the story is strong enough and it talks for itself. I really don't need help, and this is why I didn't want it to be narrated, and it was extremely difficult not to bring narration in it, because it's so complicated. And
it's pretty complicated.
It's so complicated. There's so much information that you have to tell to people that they would be able to understand.
Absolutely, and I think coming to it with history and having read some stuff and knowing that and so on is helpful. But I think, to your earlier point about kids seeing it, I think anyone can kind of see that film and come away and go, wow, I need to rethink this.
Yeah, but when I'm just thinking, you know, hope and future. And so for me, they're the next generation, and they, I would love people to grow up with this film in their head. I don't want it. Maybe it sounds like a little bit big, you know. Okay, I will tell you a small story.
Okay.
When it was premiered in Jerusalem Film Festival this July, and was accepted great, and we got some prizes. But on the tech check before the screening, so usually you just come in and you have like a few minutes and you're going out. The tech person from the Jerusalem Cinematheque just pushed the button and we started to watch the film. And I see that he's not stopping. And we're watching, and I'm like, okay, for me it's great, with like the tech check is. And then I'm looking back and I seen him standing and watching the film. And then I came to him and he cried. He was standing there and crying, and he was an Israeli Arab.
Mm.
Right. And he looked at me and said, Maya, that's terrible. That's terrible. It means that we have no hope here.
Wow.
And he cried for himself.
Right.
He cried for him, for himself. And I looked at him and I told him, but listen, if there would be one person that will come out of this screen and even a little bit will change his mind, we did something, right?
Yeah.
And he said, yes, you're right. So I told him, so let's do the screen really, really good. And no, but that's the thing. Even if one person that comes out of this film and saying, okay, I understand a little bit more, that's good.
I think it's fantastic. Yeah, congratulations on the film. I think
Thank
it's
you.
A wonderful
Thank
film.
Thank you very much.
As a documentary, I really do. I truly do. And it's, but it's engaging. The music's brilliant, by the way.
Yes, I know.
So we were compelling. Yes. It just drew me
We were very lucky to have Steven Renix, that he's actually the composer of Room.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And he did an amazing job.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Maya Zinchstein, and her film Forever Pure, international premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival, here in live today in September 2016. Hopefully it'll get a little cooler for you.
Yeah.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Toronto. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.